It is 8:35. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. I'm Maeve Conran and I'm delighted to have in the studio my guest Hunter Lovins with us this morning. And of course, she's no stranger to many of our listeners as having really written the book about sustainable business practices. And that was 20 years ago. That book was Natural Capitalism. Of course, she's the co-founder and president of Natural Capitalism Solutions. And she's got a brand new book out, A Finer Future. And that's what we're going to talk about today. A Finer Future, Creating an Economy in Service to Life. And Hunter Lovins will speak about that book next Wednesday, January 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Boulder Bookstore. But you'll join us right now to talk about it. Welcome.
And Thank you so much.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
And is it a Happy New Year for you, Hunter? Because you seem eternally optimistic about the future of the planet, given the very dire predictions that we have been getting, particularly at the end of 2018 with the latest climate report coming out. People now moving away from saying climate change to climate chaos and climate catastrophe. But your new book, and certainly your life's work, really recognises that we still can make change. You're still on that trip, right? We're still hopeful at this point.
I walked into a Christmas party on Christmas and the people all said, "Hunter, tell us that you're still optimistic." And I said, "Absolutely. This is the finest time to be alive. We are in a horse race with catastrophe. The good news, we're in the race. We have all the technologies we need to solve all of the problems facing us. Doing so will be profitable. Doing so will give us a higher quality of life. And it'll be fun." Now, having said that it will be fun, we, for example, I work with a man named Tony Seba, a folk in Boulder. Should not find him a stranger. He spoke for Clean Energy Action about a year and a half ago, spoke for the World Affairs Council last April. Tony says inevitably, by 2030, because of fundamental economic reasons, the world will be 100% renewably powered. Those four reasons are fall in the cost of solar, fall in the cost of storage, batteries, the electric car, and the driverless car. And if you follow the news, you see this happening all around us. So the latest news is Shenzhen, China now has 100% electric buses. Next year it'll be 100% electric taxis. That cut the city's fuel bill in half, just the electric buses. The automakers are now afraid that they're going to lose their business because everybody's saying, "Oh, I'm going to wait till the electric cars are here." Well, they're here. I drove one here this morning to the station. You can go over to Boulder Nissan, talk to Nigel. He can equip you with a brilliant little Leaf. That's what I drive. Or if you really want to splurge, you can get a Tesla. And again, these are higher quality cars. My Leaf is the finest car I've ever driven. I love the thing. Now, if Tony's right, and I think he is, we will solve the climate crisis, well, we'll solve half the climate crisis at a profit by 2030, and we'll crash the global economy because we are looking at the dissolution in value of oil, gas, coal, uranium, nuclear, the utility industry, the auto industry, the banks that hold paper in them, the pension funds and insurance companies that are invested in them. This is going to be the mother of all disruptions.
Well, now, we're still, though, seeing massive influence on the part of the oil and gas industry at a state level, at a local level, and certainly at a federal level. So is that the last breath of a dying industry? Or
yes.
Is this, I mean, how, 2030 is not that far away.
It's very fast. And I look at it every time I see Tony. I say, "Tony, are you sure?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, now I'm convinced." So let's look at some of the evidence. A bit over a year ago, Xcel, our local utility, put out an all-sources bid. Who can supply us 1,100 megawatts from any source, any price? The lowest fossil bid was 4 cents a kilowatt hour. Wind was a little below 2 cents. Solar was a little above 2 cents. Wind plus solar plus storage, 3 cents. There is no fossil energy that can supply us electricity in Colorado cheaper than wind and solar. And when you couple wind and solar with batteries, you have fixed firm 24-hour power. So it's happening. And that's why Xcel then went to the PUC and said, "Oh, well, we'll close two coal plants and pledge to be 60% renewable. I'm not quite sure why they didn't say 100%, but give them a year or two. We're seeing Volkswagen say that 2023 will be their last combustion engine. General Motors just closed 6 factories, thereby idling 34,000 people, which is not good, saying we're getting ready for the electric car and the driverless car. Now, it would be nice if we had some policy saying that when a big industry, which we the taxpayers bailed out a few years ago, makes this kind of industrial shift, they ensure that the workers are cared for, that it is imperative that we make this shift in a just way. And this is what the Green New Deal is endeavoring to do. And I could quibble with various bits of the Green New Deal, but overall, it's pretty darn good. So let's pass it.
Well, Congress is reconvening. Tomorrow, we're going to see state legislators reconvening in at the Capitol in Denver. And many of them are new lawmakers, many of them running on a platform of stricter oil and gas regulation. And yet, at the same time, we're seeing a lot of skepticism that I think is well deserved, given the history of how oil and gas has influenced, say, state politics, that real change would happen. What would you like to see happen in the early days of for federal lawmakers and also here at a state level? Because it does seem that a lot of these changes are happening not because of federal policy, but despite federal policy, and they're happening at a local and state level.
You've got that right. It is the cities, it is the states, it's the regions that are leading the way now. Our Cheeto in chief has abrogated the issue of climate change, well, of responsibility in any way, shape, or form. And so citizens, ordinary people putting solar on their roofs, cities pledging to go 100% renewable, of which there are over 1,000 now, states saying we're still in the Paris Accord. These are the real leaders in today's world. But I am hopeful after the 2018 elections, record number of women, record number of people of color, people are stepping up and saying we want change. Now, the young legislators, both at a state level, at a national level, are going to have to find their courage. They are going to be met by the entrenched interests. You and I and the rest of the world's taxpayers subsidize the oil and gas industry, coal industry, to the tune of $5.3 trillion a year. These are giveaways to the fossil industry. It's time that we stop that. So the first thing I would like is to try to move more toward a real market in energy. Get rid of all the subsidies. Oh, but the renewables can't live without their subsidies. Yeah, they can. The subsidies given to the fossil industry are at least 12 times as large as all the subsidies ever given to renewables, to energy efficiency. And I believe in the tooth fairy, too. So then let's start looking at specific things that we can do. Here in Colorado, the proposition to limit fracking near schools, near homes, was a very good one. It lost because the industry threw millions of dollars against it. It's amazing it did as well as it did, and kudos to Colorado Rising and the others who brought this forward. Now it's time to go to the legislature and say, let's have science-based regulation of oil and gas. If this stuff is dangerous, if asthma levels, if cancer levels near fracking sites are unusually high, let's start requiring that the industry limit fracking near our homes, near our schools, and be financially responsible for the damage that they're causing. Now, they aren't going to like this because the fracking industry is heavily leveraged. What that means is it's deeply in debt. It has not been a profitable enterprise in any of the quarters since it started. And this is work by IEFA, IEEFA, which has been tracking the finances of the fracking industry. They keep punching holes because the gas that they can extract runs out in 6 to 9 months. So they got to go punch another hole. Punching holes is very expensive, so they have to go borrow money for the new ones, saying, if we can just keep doing this, we'll be profitable. You'll get your money back. And this Ponzi scheme is just about to be up. So why on earth should we, the people, be bearing the health costs And the risk, these things, these old pipelines blow up every now and again, as one did in Firestone. Active pipelines blow up, as they have in Massachusetts, up north here in Colorado. And we ought to be saying to the industry, you are profiting massively from this borrowing, so you be responsible. And what you will see if we don't do this is, as soon as the economics all fall in and fuel prices are crashing right now, then the industry will just pick up and leave, and we will be stuck having to pay to clean it all up. This has been the case of boom-bust industries through history. So let's insist now. They put up bonds that they cannot drill near to our schools, our homes. Colorado Rising is correct. This stuff is dangerous. We don't want it in our communities. Second thing, let's give communities the ability to say, thanks, no, we don't want you in our communities. And this will put at least a responsible dampener on the amount of damage that the industry can do.
Well, you've just brought into question two major tenets of what's happening here in Colorado with oil and gas. The first one being the whole economic foundation of the oil and gas industry, and really how it's based, as you said, on future speculation of oil and gas prices, but also not taking into account the external costs, the health costs, the environmental costs of that. The second thing you brought into question is this idea of local control, and that has been the basis of so much of the conflict of oil and gas regulation here in the state. Those are two things that the legislature could change. Governor Polis, governor-elect until next Tuesday at the inauguration, he could change. But people are still sceptical that we're going to see big change. What are your thoughts?
Politicians do what you demand they do. Politics is a contact sport. It is not a spectator sport. If you're not in it, the politicians will happily default to doing the easy thing. And this includes the very best politicians that we could ever elect. I know Jared. He's a good man. I served on his transition team. I'm going to be there demanding that he do the right thing. And I'm going to be paying attention to what he does and to what our legislators do. If we're active as citizens, the politicians will pay attention. So really, it's on us.
What are a couple of pieces of legislation you would like to see introduced in the 2019 session that would really make inroads into what we're talking about today?
I would like to see microgrids made easy to do.
What's a microgrid?
A microgrid is the microest of grids is what I have on the ranch. I have solar panels in the front yard. I have batteries in my garage. When it flooded in 2013, we partied on. Called my neighbor, said, hey, if you want to come charge your cell phone or if stuff's rotting in your fridge, bring it over. We had power because we have our own tiny little grid. Now, what microgrids typically mean is neighbors, a community, gets together and puts up solar, puts up a wind turbine, if you happen to have wind, and puts up some battery storage, and your little region is now self-sufficient. You hook to the grid. I'm hooked to the grid. Right now, I'm not home. My solar system is chunking out electrons, which is happily going into the grid and helping somebody else.
So what are the current barriers to more people maybe having microgrids? Because I know there was discussion around solar gardens and other things like that, that might be another term that people
are familiar with. A solar garden is a microgrid, loosely speaking. If you have, for example, if I were to add solar panels to my system and say to my neighbors, here, you can buy from me, I would become a utility. That, at the moment, that's not legal. There are regulations that give utilities, like Xcel, the monopoly power. And the deal was the utility guaranteed that when you flip the switch, the lights will come on. And for that, they were given the monopoly and a guaranteed rate of return. Good business if you can get it. I think we ought to be saying to the utilities, either you be the microgrid creator. And the trouble with that is they don't really know how to, and they're not really good at it. So say to them, fine, you have the monopoly power. We will tie your rate of return to ensuring that every community has its own microgrid, or, and give them a very narrow period of time in which to do this and do it responsibly, or we're going to take the monopoly away from you and allow communities like Boulder to municipalize. The state ought to be making it, as the PUC in this case, ought to be making it as easy as possible for Boulder to municipalize if Xcel will not deliver to them what the people of Boulder have repeatedly said that they want, which is 100% renewable power. But if Xcel does that, they ought to be doing that for everyone in their service territory, and they ought to be going at warp speed to deliver 100% renewables. Now, you can argue whether municipalization or investor-owned utilities are a better model. The reason I favor municipalization is we the people own the utility. Now, you could say we the people have not been terribly good at running the services of government, and we can argue about that, but if they, the investor-owned utility, are the power provider, those investors that own the utility are going to take their cut, which is to say you and I are going to pay higher rates. Where municipalization has occurred, rates have gone down. So if what you want is cheap renewables, then you ought to be in favor of municipalization. If what you want is a national, global transition where as few people as possible get hurt, maybe we want to be encouraging the utilities to make this transition. When California said, we're going to go 100% renewable, the people who fought it initially was the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. They said, wait a minute, those utility workers are our members. And so California had to say, we'll find ways to take care of your workers. And then IBEW said, okay, we're in favor, and California has pledged to go 100% renewably powered. So, again, we have to be sure that we take care of the people involved in this. Whether or not an investor-owned utility continues to profit, I don't care. But in saying I don't care, when you start taking down big chunks of the economy, like the auto industry, if we go to autonomous vehicles, as Tony says we will, that's 8 million drivers out of work. What are we going to do with the drivers? It's not taxi drivers versus Uber drivers. They're both out of work. And again, it's happening. I was in Vegas a couple weeks ago for the National Finals Rodeo and whistled up a Lyft. And up popped a dialogue box, did I want an autonomous vehicle? Yes! Yes! As it turned out, I didn't get one. Either they're just doing a survey to see whether or not people will take it, or they really have these things on the road. I know they have them in Arizona, in Pittsburgh, in various other cities. AEVs will be truly cool. If we had an AEV system, autonomous electric vehicle, then we'd need 1/6 the number of cars running around on the road. We'd need no parking spaces, no parking garages. You'd never park a car. It would cost you 1/10 what it does now to buy, maintain, fuel, and insure a private vehicle. You just whistle one of these things up. It takes you where you want to go at 1/10 the cost. Because there's no driver. But because there's no driver, what do we do with all those drivers?
And what do we do with all of those drivers?
Again, this is this issue of a just transition. And it's what the Green New Deal is set up to do, of worker retraining. I was in a Lyft outside of New York City. And I said, do you like driving for Lyft? The guy said, no, I hate it. I used to be a cab driver. I paid $1 million to buy my medallion. And the shared rides put me out of business. It's like, ouch, $1 million. This guy's just trying to feed his family. AEVs put him out of work, totally. So the best proposal that I've seen, and we write this up in the book, A Finer Future, is what's called guaranteed jobs. This is a proposal by Dr. Randall Ray and his colleagues from the Bard Levy Center of Economics, that the government gives to nonprofits, and I believe local governments, however much money they can responsibly deploy hiring people to do the work that's needed in society. You look around us, there's a lot of work that is needed. Cleaning up all of the environmental disasters, caring for young people, teaching, caring for elderly. And these people would be paid a minimum of $15 an hour plus full benefits, health care, retirement, child care, which is to say, if the corporates want to compete for best talent, they have to bring their rates up. Now you have everyone who wants a job having one, and you have done away with poverty and gone a long way to dealing with the inequality that is now tearing our society apart.
We're speaking with Hunter Lovins today here at KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. She's well known to our KGNU listening audience, based right here locally in Boulder County, but she's worldwide known for sustainable business practices. And in fact, she launched the revolution around sustainable business in about 20 years ago with the publication in 1999 of Natural Capitalism. She's the president of Natural Capitalism Solutions, and her latest book is A Finer Future, Creating an Economy in Service to Life. And she'll be speaking about that next Wednesday, January 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Boulder Bookstore. Well, Hunter, getting back to your book, because it really is a blueprint, was this a crowdsourced book? Because I remember back in 2017, you were really reaching out to folks to say, this is something we want a lot of people to come together to fund the book, but we also want to crowdsource ideas as well.
It was very much a crowdsourced book. We convened here in the Boulder Valley a group called the Finer Future Forum, and about 15 people came together and over about a six-month period discussed these ideas. Many of the members helped edit early versions of the book. And when I first wrote it, the first chapter was, really? No kidding, we're in trouble. And the readers said, we can't get through this. It's just too grim. So on their advice, I rewrote it to be, it's 2050 and we made it. And here's what the world feels like to live in an economy in service to life. Every assertion is footnoted. This is happening already somewhere on the planet. And the readers said, this is great. We can get through this. And I used it as a device to say, remember back in 2018 how we were struggling with all of these challenges? But here's what we did about it. And then the rest of the book is, how do we do that? First of all, how did we get into this mess? And it turns out it was a story. 36 men gathered at a hotel outside Montreux, Switzerland in 1947. And yeah, they were all men. And they argued for 10 days and crafted what is now called neoliberalism, which is this ideology that we're all greedy bastards, but that's okay because the market is perfect. And in a perfect market, you against me will somehow aggregate to the greater good for all. So we don't need government. The market will do it. No, it won't, and it hasn't. And we are on the edge of a cliff. As you mentioned earlier, the recent climate science is incredibly scary. We have, they now reckon, 12 years to turn around climate chaos, or we really will be in a catastrophe. 12 years is not long, so Tony Seba better be right. But we know what to do. First of all, stop emissions. Second of all, implement regenerative agriculture. And the book describes the work of people like Gabe Brown, North Dakota corn soybean commodity farmer who was going broke. Because he was going broke, he said, I'll try anything. First, he went to no-till. He stopped breaking the soil and inverting it. Then he went to planting deep-rooted cover crops. The roots go deep into the soil, taking carbon with them. Because what plants do when they photosynthesize is take carbon out of the air, put it in the roots. When something disturbs the soil, or disturbs the plants, actually, the roots slough sugars, polysaccharides. That feeds the microbiological community in the soil, particularly some stuff called mycorrhizal fungi. That mineralizes the carbon that the roots are sloughing off. That's why when the pioneers came across the Great Plains, they found 10 feet of thick black soil. So Gabe stopped breaking the soil. That kept what he calls armor on the soil. The cover crops helped cool the soil, helped take carbon deep into it. Then he put animals out on it. The animal action is what drives the carbon deep into the soil, just as the bison used to do on the Great Plains. They would eat everything. They were dense packed because there were wolves. Now we use electric fences. They ate everything. Their hooves chopped it up. They fertilized it. And then they moved on. They didn't come back until the grass had regrown. This action, as the Savory Institute, headquartered here in Boulder, has been pointing out, is what made the world's grasslands the second largest carbon sink in the world after the oceans. But we have been desertifying the world's grasslands, and we know how to use them as this great carbon sink. That's what Gabe is doing. It's what Will Harris is doing at White Oak Pastures down in Georgia. His 2,500 acres employs 137 people. His neighbor commodity peanut farmer employs four. So he's rebuilding the community of Bluffton, Georgia. It's what Joel Salatin does at Polyface Farms. These examples of regenerative agriculture are popping up all across the country, all around the world, and it is the second half of solving the climate crisis at a profit, because Gabe's wildly profitable, Will's profitable, Joel's profitable. These guys are showing how you can be on the land, have this life that they love, feed your family, feed your community, and drive the local economy.
We've had many examples of local farmers from Olin Farms, Mark Guttridge, pioneering really carbon sequestration on his farm, and many others. That seems to be happening on a smaller scale, certainly here. Can those regenerative practices be scaled up? Because what we also have here is massive industrial agricultural practices, particularly when it comes to animals. If you drive east here of Boulder, just head out to Weld County and you see, you know, close to Greeley, all those massive animal lots, those farm lots. I mean, can that all be changed to get back to this free-ranging animals on the range to benefit the soil? Can we have those regenerative practices scaled up given the current state of our economy when it comes to agriculture?
One of the things that a group of us are doing is creating here in the Boulder-Denver area. Actually, we call it the Upper South Platte Watershed.
It's always good to connect to where your water is coming from.
I think
that's a good way to approach it.
And my friend John Fullerton, who's one of the co-authors on A Finer Future, and introduced this concept of regenerative economics, said we ought to try to solve these issues on a watershed basis. And I said, Mo, what is our watershed? I mean, my personal one is Little Elk Creek. Here it's Boulder Creek. But what's the watershed of the region? So I got out a map. I was like, oh, it's the Upper South Platte, which neatly encompasses Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins, leaves out Colorado Springs. They're on the Arkansas watershed, but that's all right. I don't want to get this thing too big to start with. You know, initially I said, well, maybe the Front Range. What, does that run from Albuquerque to Calgary? I'm like, that's too big. So what we're trying to do is build a regenerative economy here locally. And so I said, what is our economy? So I assigned an intern to looking it up. And it turns out industrial agriculture in Colorado is contracting. It's dying. What isn't dying is natural foods, is organic production. These are growing at double digits every year, whereas conventional agriculture here in Colorado is dropping by percentage points every year. And if we look at what is the extractive industry base, the oil, gas, mining, timber, industrial agriculture, these are a fraction of the size of what you might call the regenerative economy, natural foods, outdoor industries, the cannabis industry, clean energy, education, startups, the entrepreneurial economy. These are all growing, and this is what we want more of. So I think one of the first things that we need to do here in Colorado, and as part of Jared's transition team, I put this forward, is get a real grip on what is the economy that is sustaining us, which part of it is growing and flourishing, which part of it is dying, and start pruning away the dying bits and start encouraging the regenerative bits as part of a deliberate transition to a regenerative economy in the Upper South Platte watershed.
It seems that that issue of subsidizing that we talked about earlier in terms of the energy industry, that's a big issue in agriculture as well. We're seeing massive subsidies to some of the commodity crops, soybeans, corns, and then a really hard time even just getting basic crop insurance for some of the smaller market farmers here locally along the Front Range. But a lot of this seems to also be driven by consumer choice. And yet, as consumers, we're still addicted to cheap food that doesn't reflect the environmental and certainly not the labour costs that go into our food. And also cheap clothing, because that's very much connected to agriculture as well. So how do we change those key consumer behaviour so it's not just a lifestyle choice to go and shop at your local farmer's market, that it's an actual part of everyone's life? Because I know fundamental to all of your work, Hunter Lovins, is this idea that it's for everybody and not just the select elite few who can afford all of this.
It has to be for everyone. And it's one of the reasons, you know, some of my more radical friends criticized me when I did some work with Walmart. But Walmart said, we want to make organic affordable to everyone. Now, what they did was buy big industrial organic. And so, you know, we continue to push on Walmart of buy local, buy from people who you can go and have a conversation with. But the real answer, as you said, is us, is making the choices. So shopping at the Boulder Farmers Market, at the Longmont Farmers Market, shopping from people who grow here in the Boulder Valley, joining Woody Tash's slow money movement. I sat in on one of their sessions. You pay, I believe it's $250 to become a member. Every month they have a potluck. Everybody brings something local to eat. And then they collectively decide who they're going to make loans to from the local agricultural community at zero interest. This is not a how do you get rich quick scheme. This is a how do you nourish the local agricultural community that can nourish us. I mean, Woody's just brilliant about all of this stuff. And this is the sort of thing every one of us ought to be joining and being a part of if we want to see locally sustainable agriculture. If we had some big storms in the mountains, closed the passes, you may remember a few years back this happened, 3 days the grocery store shelves were empty. We are dependent on food being trucked in 1,000 miles. The average molecule of food in this country travels 2,500 miles before anybody eats it, and it tastes like that. So the first thing all of us can do is, with at least part of our food budget, shop local. Find out who in your area is growing and buy from them. The second thing that all of us can do is to get active politically. Colorado has a Agriculture Commission, which historically has been run by good old boys. And one of Jared's first appointments is a young woman from the Western Slope who has been working at the Young Farmers Union, who is now the Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Colorado. She's been working with local family farms, and you bet I'm going to be having a conversation with her.
We're speaking with Hunter Lovins today on KGNU. She, of course, is the president of Natural Capitalism Solutions. 20 years ago, 1999 it was, her best-known book, Natural Capitalism, came out. And she's won so many awards for her work over the years, including the Rachel Carson Award. She's co-authored, gosh, about 15 books. Her latest is A Finer Future, Creating an Economy in Service to Life. And she's going to speak about that at the Boulder Bookstore next Wednesday, January 9th at 7:30. And she's also part of the transition team for Governor-elect Jared Polis. He'll have his inauguration next Tuesday when he will be the governor. And if you have a question or a comment about what we're talking about this morning, I invite you to call us at 303-442-4242. Well, your book, A Finer Future, lays out all of these different areas that change is already happening in, as you said, you give examples of this happening somewhere in the world. So it's not just a far off future. This is actually happening. We've talked about agriculture. We've talked about energy. You also talk about transforming finance and corporations. And so much of our financial system is so tied to the oil and gas industry. Now, we have seen a big movement around divestment that has actually been successful. But talk about how transforming finance and corporations is happening, could be happening, and what that can do to get us to this finer future that you write about.
Among other things, I am CEO of a little company called Change Finance, and our goal is to do just that. We created the first truly fossil fuel-free exchange-traded fund. An ETF is like a mutual fund, except it trades every day on the New York Stock Exchange. I helped ring the bell on Wall Street a little over a year ago. The New York Common Fund, big pension fund for the state of New York, had it divested 10 years ago, would have made $17.5 billion more than it did because it insists on holding fossil stocks. If you're worried about what your money is doing, particularly in a down market, you might want to take a look at whether your mutual fund owns fossil stocks. Those things are falling, and they will fall further in the future. Why on earth do you want to own this stuff? So you personally can be part of this transition. You can check us out at change-finance.com. You can check out funds like Green Alpha, also here in Boulder. There are a growing number of socially responsible investment options where you can put your money. The interesting thing of the SRI funds in general, they outperform the general market, and they have done for about 10 years. This is actually a better way to manage your money. Now, all investing is risky, particularly in a down market, but it's where I have my money. We need to do this on a global scale. We have financialized the economy. And what that really is a global casino. We're just gambling. We're speculating, as opposed to investing in the real economy. So we need to start shifting the economy away from this financial speculation and more towards investment in real people, real jobs, the real work that needs to be done. And in the book, we walk through a number of measures of how we can do this. People like Elizabeth Warren have been calling for such measures. One thing that would be very good to do is a financial transactions tax. Every time you trade stock, you pay a fraction of a penny of a tax. The first thing this would do is damp down the velocity of trade. You and I are not made better off by increased velocity in trading stocks. We get nothing from that. The traders do. So why does the market shoot up and shoot down? The traders make a lot of money every time the market moves. Our interest is in having a real local economy prosper. So we want to start shifting money away from Wall Street to Main Street. We could well be headed into a nasty economy. Again, as I mentioned, if we disappear all of the incumbent industries in the next 10 years, which could very well happen. I was watching a little video last night about how the automobile industry is about to collapse. Again, in part because of electric cars, in part because it's heavily leveraged, in part because the guy described the leasing phenomenon as crack for the automobile industry, and how all of this is unsustainable. If Tony's right, yeah, it's unsustainable. If all of that starts to collapse, the national economy, the global economy, could be in a nasty downturn. Where do you put your money? Put it in what's real. Put it in your local community. There are things called local stock exchanges. My friend Mark Campanelli, who founded Carbon Tracker in the UK, built a local stock exchange where little local companies that are being created can issue local stock and you can buy it. There are literally hundreds of measures that we could start implementing to begin to transform the financial sector.
But Hunter Lovins is our guest today. We have several callers
Perfect.
Who would like to join the conversation. We might have to get you to take off your trademark hat there, Hunter. Pop on some headphones as we welcome our first caller. We've got Robert on the line. You're live on KGNU. What's your question or comment?
Well, thank you very much. Hunter, it's so good to hear you. I wonder if you would address the issue of how we are wasting resources in society, especially whole buildings. It seems to have gone exponential. There just seems to be no end that massive buildings all over, even in so-called progressive Boulder, are being torn down and replaced, which makes a lot of destruction to nature in replacing that. It wastes resources, wastes energy, causes pollution, destroys the history and culture of a place, and jeopardizes it harms social stability as well. And it's just shocking to see whole good apartment buildings, office buildings, homes torn down and replaced with huge other buildings that have no connection really to the community, that overshadow what's around them, that harms the community in so many ways. And the justification is, well, these are energy efficient buildings. We're doing a good thing by taking down the old inefficient and building up new efficient green buildings.
Well, as you know, the most efficient building is the one that's already standing, which you then implement the well-known building efficiency technologies inside of. So you're spot on. If anybody wants to see how this is done, check out the Alliance Center in Denver, where they took a 100-year-old warehouse building and turned it into a truly delightful shared workspace with all of the latest energy efficiency technologies, a microgrid on its roof, direct current, batteries in the basement. Go take a tour of the Alliance Center if you want to see what we can do to save older buildings. So yeah, you're spot on. Let's try to keep our historic buildings standing and slow down this rush to so-called modernization by tearing down great old buildings.
Well, good point, Robert. And does this need to then happen with building policies? That can happen at a hyper-local level.
Yes, yes. And part of it is the ownership structure. Who owns your community? I bet most of us don't know. Most of downtown Boulder is owned, I believe, by four men. And so perhaps we need local land trusts to begin buying up the local real estate. We certainly need protection for good older buildings. We need local community choice of what kind of development is going to happen in our neighborhoods. Boulder had a very nasty fight over that a few years ago. This issue is not going to go away. I think we need local control over what kind of a community do we want to have.
Okay. Well, Robert, thanks for your call. Local control, of course, came up earlier in terms of local control of oil and gas regulation. We'll see what happens with that. But we'll go to our next caller. I believe is it Gerard? You're calling in from Denver. You're live on the air.
Hello.
You're live on KGNU this morning with Hunter Lovins.
Yes. I have a question. I'm interested in your solar system. I have solar panels on my roof, and I also driving a Leaf. And I love it. My solar system produces on average 20 kilowatt hours a day. My house uses on average 10 kilowatt hours a day. I cannot find a battery big enough to store the kilowatt hours which I would need to be independent. What kind of batteries do you have?
You don't want to replicate my system. My system is a decade old. It's old lead-acid deep-cycle marine batteries all ganged together. Uh-huh. My favorite battery technology right now is a company called Simplify, Simpla PHI. They have lithium-ion ferrous phosphate batteries. These They don't have the lithium ion cobalt. Cobalt's a conflict mineral, and it's nasty, toxic. The batteries, like are in Teslas or in your phone, get hot. Simplify batteries don't get hot. The Department of Defense buys these things to run their forward operating bases in places like Afghanistan because they don't have a heat signature. After Hurricane Maria, Simplify and a solar company in the Midwest teamed up and took container loads of solar panels and batteries to Dominica and got the country back up and running. So if they can run a country off these things, you can sure run your house and your leaf.
Yes, I see. I was looking at Gold Zero Company. They have batteries, but the biggest one only holds 3 kilowatt hours. That's not big enough for be independent.
Check out Simplify. And then go and talk to your local solar company and see if they can put you in a great battery storage system.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks
you
for your call, Jared. And that goes back to that question that you talked about earlier, Hunter, that the technology is there. You might need to root around for it a little bit. But you were saying, I mean, this technology exists to overcome many of the problems that we're experiencing.
Yeah, they're putting it in now in places like Puerto Rico. They're putting microgrids in. Of course, the old coal-fired utility in Puerto Rico is fighting them tooth and nail. And this is going to be a fight for the next 10 years or so. I think what we need to keep in mind is we can build a finer future. We know how to. We have all the technologies. And just not give up.
Well, we have a lot of calls coming in this morning to talk to Hunter Lovins here on KGNU. We'll go next to Strider, calling in from Longmont. You're live on KGNU this morning.
Thank you, Maeve. Hunter, yeah, I heard you. We had a sustainability fair here in Longmont about 10 years ago, and you were keynote speaker, and we were getting a lot going, but then we had a reactionary city council and outside money that ran us backwards. So it's always part of the political game, too. For example, I live in a trailer park, and we're not allowed to use our own internet that we've been paying for because of the corruption and the payoffs that are going to the owners of the trailer park. So many things. There's a farmers group, I think, called Carbon Farming or something that's great. One thing, if we could have a real public forum and community dialogue and a different form of interchange, both literary and vocal, like the Chautauqua movement 100 years ago. We don't have anything like that anymore, and maybe the social media does that, but it's so corrupted. I wonder if you could address that. And also, I'm giving a Martin Luther King sermon at Longmont UCC in a couple of weeks entitled Building the Beloved Community in Time of Crisis. And it's seriously political, moral, ethical, but it's also economics that we have to do that. And I'll just give one closer. Quinonia in southwest Georgia, a interracial cooperative farm started, oh gosh, way back in the 40s, has had spinoffs like Habitat for Humanity. And it was a model for us working in Alabama in the civil rights movement. So if you could address any piece of that, I would love to hear your comment.
Thanks for your call, Strider.
Well, blessings on you for being active locally. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take each one of us saying, this is my community, and I'm going to be responsible for it. You know, I've worked with people like Leslie Glostrom, who here in Boulder is a true hero fighting for renewable energy. And when Xcel made its announcement, some of the big enviro groups were claiming credit. And I wrote Leslie and said, nah, this one's on you. This has been your work for over a decade. So, Strider, keep at it. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep organizing. Remember, though, that we have to bring people along with us. it's very easy to say, this is my enemy. It's harder to say, this is a friend I haven't met yet. And reaching out to people who may not share our point of view, but who share our desire for a future that works for all of us, and saying, what do you think it will take to create that future? How can we work together to do that? Again, it is urgent. Time is very short. The impacts of climate change are going to get worse and worse. And we are going to have to start learning to take care of each other, our neighbors, our communities, and working together.
Well, Strider, thanks for your call. We've lots of calls. I'm not sure we'll get to all of them, but we'll go next to Lynn calling from Boulder. You're live on KGNU. And Lynn, if you could turn down your radio. Okay, it sounds like we've got a lapse there. So we'll go next to John. You're live on KGNU this morning.
Am I?
Yes.
It's a good program. We all live in hope of someday perhaps having government for the people. It's a great idea. In the meantime, with this UN climate plan initiative, in that framework, it would seem to me to be marvelous if we could somehow get towards a worldwide carbon tax and Tobin tax, and use those proceeds then to address the problem. But more locally, I'm really pleased to hear that maybe the governor is listening to farming and soil things. It seems to me the long-term problem, too, needs us to stop mining the soil, and in fact, maybe it take as a personal responsibility the making of soil. That we should all be doing that in a small or a larger way.
You got that right. Gabe Brown, the man I mentioned earlier, has a brilliant new book out called Dirt to Soil, and I highly recommend it. He describes what it is he did on his farm, how taking care of the soil, being first and foremost a soil farmer, is what has made him profitable. And this is something every one of us can do in our yards. You can start taking care of your own soil. You can start composting your food waste and putting it back into your soil. There's just so many things that we can do here locally. I'm not a big fan of carbon taxes. Taxes reliably raise money. They don't reliably cut carbon. So I prefer the kind of system California has, where they put a cap on the amount of carbon that can be emitted, and then set up a very well-regulated market to allow people to trade reductions in carbon. California is committed to being zero carbon and showing that it can be done. California, by the way, under this system, went from the world's eighth largest economy to now the world's fifth largest. So this sort of thing's profitable.
Well, thanks for your call, John. Thanks to everyone who's called in. We just have a couple of minutes left this morning with Hunter Lovins. Her latest book, she's going to be talking about it next Wednesday at the Boulder Bookstore. It's called A Finer Future. And Hunter, you said the initial draft of the book was not as optimistic as the final draft of the book. And so you've taken this, I suppose, this stance of saying, imagine we're in 2050 and we made it. So what does 2050 look like in the book, A Finer Future? But really, realistically speaking, in your mind, what are we going to be living like?
In the book, an 80-year-old woman wakes up in a co-housing development in Jakarta, Indonesia, and is celebrating how she's able to live independently in a co-housing situation. We have co-housing here in Boulder. A young African woman is attending the Bard MBA program at which I teach in New York City, steps off a electric tram, and helps another young woman who is gardening on Broadway in Manhattan. We can transform our city streets into gardens. It describes the work of the Savory Institute in Africa. It describes what's going on in cities in China. These measures are happening around the world. When rabbits are threatened, they freeze. When humans are threatened, we entrepreneur. We can build a finer future. And what we set out to do in this book is to prove that each of the steps that we need to take are possible, that each of them is profitable, and that collectively they will give us a world that works for 100% of humanity.
Well, A Finer Future is the title of Hunter Lovin's latest book, Creating an Economy in Service to Life. She'll speak about it next Wednesday. That's January 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Boulder Bookstore. We have more information and a link to her website for Natural Capitalism Solutions. That's online at kgnu.org. And as we head into new legislative session, with Governor-elect Polis being inaugurated next Tuesday, you're part of his transition team. We'll be paying attention to all those areas that you've identified. And thank you very much for coming in and being with us on KGNU today.
Maeve, thanks so much. And thanks to all of you out there. Thanks for being active.
It is 9:30. You're listening to KGNU. Stay tuned for the Morning Sound Alternative.